A poetic valedictory today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. Ryan Collins joins us today to share a special group of poems on Scribble. I must say that Mr. Stahl has been on this program perhaps more frequently than any other writer in the Quad Cities. Not only when Roel and I first talked to him a couple of times, then we replayed those, and now here we are again, on his birthday. And how did this come about?
Well, we have to thank his wife, Helen Stahl, because when Dick had been moved home for hospice care, I hadn't even known he'd been sick. And Ann Bowden called me and said, you know, you may want to get over there. So when I got there, he joyfully informed me that he had written 74 poems from the moment he got his diagnosis of cancer until he could no longer write, and they had collected them. Helen had the manuscript, and Ryan and I were both graced by their generosity in letting us read them. So Ryan and I talked not long after Dick passed about how extraordinary the work was, and so we've had in mind for a while that we would like to figure out how to publish the collection, but also share some of the poems with the people of the Quad Cities who knew and loved him.
Dick just never stopped writing, did
no.
he?
No.
No. Yeah. No, he didn't. And it's not surprising, I don't think.
No.
But it's an extraordinary manuscript, and I just want to echo what Rebecca said about Helen and her generosity and trusting. I feel really blessed to be able to read these poems. I knew that he was writing some poems. I heard that he had been writing poems through his treatment and everything. And then I saw the manuscript for the first time at his visitation. And I was immediately struck just by the daunting nature of the project.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who tries to write frequently and has a regular practice and likes projects and things like that, this seems so overwhelming. And there's a grace about the whole book, and like the generosity, I think that Helen showed us with sharing these poems is, Dick had that same spirit, and it's all of these poems are infused with that.
Do you think that will be published?
I hope so. I mean, I've talked to Helen about it a couple times, and I hope. I hope I can be a part of bringing this book into the world. We've talked about it at the Writing Center on our imprint, MWC Press. We've looked at some other options. I've told Helen I'm happy to do whatever I can to help this find a good home. And if that home is local, then that's, I think, even better and more fitting, I think.
You know, it's interesting, the poetic impulse. How Dick would just naturally turn to writing a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote many occasional poems. Matter of fact, I think almost every occasion in his life elicited some kind of poem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
He was always in the audience with his notebooks. And, he came to, I think, every workshop I ever gave. And he'd be one of the first to raise his hand after a prompt, and he always had something that made you stop at some point and go, wow, he just did that in the last 5 minutes. But he
You know, I've been interested in, as my life lengthens, you know, it's got to end at some point. We all do. And the whole business of some people deserve to be remembered. And not everyone who winds up as a statue really deserves a statue.
That's a good way to put
it. Very true.
And at times I thought it's really futile to do that because you look at some of the names on the library in Rock Island, you think, who in the heck is that?
Who are they?
They were prominent in their day, but some of them, of course, continue to be well known. But we all fade. And the reluctance to face that moves us to want to make some kind of remembrance that will last beyond the life.
Yeah.
And I think publishing his poems, his final poems, to do that. How many did he write in that?
I think there's
74
in the manuscript.
74 poems.
Which is, I mean, yeah.
And from diagnosis until he died was less than a year, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, something like that. It's just extraordinary. It's an extraordinary project to take on, especially under the circumstances. But yeah, I mean, he was just always, I remember that he took every workshop.
Yep.
That's the thing for someone who is the first poet laureate in Quad Cities and who taught for 30 years. I think like one of the things that I remember most and love most about Dick was like, he was any reading he could go to, any workshop that he could participate in, anything that he could go to related to poetry, writing, whatever, he was always there.
Yep.
And I think that's a great lesson for, you know, for anybody who's at any point with any kind of writing practice. Like, I think he's known for his occasional poems, I think, in a lot of ways. But like, I think those occasional poems, the more I think about it, I was thinking about this a lot since Rebecca asked me to do this. And I think it's less that he was writing just for the occasions. It was more that he had a predisposition to poetry, and poetry was like the window through which he looked at life.
Yeah.
And so when it was time to comment on something or record something or remember something or get through something difficult, the place that he turned to was poetry. And we see that as occasional, but to me as a poet, I see that as someone who's like attuned his whole sort of awareness and disposition toward poetry. And I think like that's maybe the most noble thing you can do with your craft and your practice.
And fully present and always humble, like you said.
Yes.
I mean, he would sit quiet. He was never a showboater, but he was always listening and attentive and had that notebook and his pen out. And oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, we can't read all 76 poems,
but I'd
like to get a sampling just so we have some idea of how Dick reacted to his situation.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're going to go chronologically. We asked Helen to choose a handful of poems that either she cared about or that meant that she knew were extra special to Dick. So that's Ryan and I are going to read them kind of in order. And you will see right away, as you said, to write about an illness, an impending death. You know, most of us would scream, why me? We would complain. We would be miserable. And he doesn't do that. So here are the first two that I'm going to read. Attitude A in Clinic A. There's an attitude here that lives on hope, recovery, and a sense of wholeness that keeps me listening for Dick S. at the door and the nurse to check my white wristband for 6:12:39 and to walk me back to the place where 6:12:39 is checked again with the computer and vials of blood taken for the clinical research program. It's all good theater, where the spotlight's always on me, my recovering health, a future well-being. 6:12:39.
Very good.
Isn't it?
I like that.
I do too. And then I'm going to read Driver. This is in honor of Helen. And one of the things that was so wonderful about them as a couple was just their devotion and their dedication and their respect for each other. You didn't even have to know them. You could just see it in how they were in a room together. So here's Driver. My wife Helen drives me to and from my many cancer appointments in Iowa City, 60 miles away, two or three times a week and every day last week and this first week of October, with many more scheduled appointments at Atomic Medicine. No wonder her arm and shoulder hurt from gripping the steering wheel too hard. She's at the wheel right now, threading between speeding semis, oversized loads, monster recreational vehicles, muscle cars, prefab houses on trucks going west, and the road antics of errant drivers grandstanding on I-80. Add her driving in adverse conditions, pelting rain, blinding sun in her eyes already compromised by macular degeneration, construction sites, and all degrees of lane changes. Now she's pushing me in a lightweight blue wheelchair where both armrests lift for convenient entering and exiting. Waiting with her at the next reception desk, I remember how she learned to drive on her father's big orange Minneapolis Moline tractor, and later on a parade of Mercury cars sporting the latest safety innovations. How lucky am I to be getting the best of care? I say cancer doesn't stand a chance against her.
Very good.
Oh, and you can see him writing it as she's driving.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, consummate storyteller. Yeah. Always.
Over to you, Ryan.
Yeah, so this is the next poem in the manuscript. And the title is also functions as the first line. And it's called, Do You Want a Warm Blanket? Do you want a warm blanket? The nurse asks right away. Yes, I reply immediately. That would be great. The narrow bed, the warm blanket, my nurse checking on me every few minutes, it seems, all make me feel special. She spreads it over me like a long, hot water bottle. The warmth penetrates to my body like my puffy red quilt I used in winter in my early years. Relief conditions carry over time like some great lost and found joy relived. I feel almost new again, knowing the shots are coming, the half-hour infusion of Keytruda and the four-hour observation. Give me a warm blanket, and I dream again.
And on and on.
Isn't that beautiful, that line, the description of the long, warm river? Is that how it
was? The water bottle.
Water bottle as a... Yeah, this the warmth and the gratitude to have the blanket, the flashback to, you know, his blanket as a younger kid.
Yeah.
Well, let's proceed then. What's the next one?
The next poem is actually the very next poem in the manuscript, and it's called Channel 109, Nature Healing. Excuse me. With lights off in the room and music muted after my infusion, I spent 4 hours in bed under a warm blanket with nature, blue sky, waterfalls in every configuration, deer, elk resting in tall grass, their antlers growing like another species of high prairie grass, mountain goats and prairie dogs. I dozed off at times with dreams of the upper Mississippi River, where my wife and I climbed the high bluffs for pictures and poems. In print, we called it bluffing. No bluffing when the nurse entered the room to check up on me and read the monitor we named Charlie, my constant companion in and out of bed. I returned to snow-covered mountains, yellow aspen leaves waving in rolling meadows, gurgling brooks washing a bed of oval rocks. In all of this calm, I never saw a human being or anything made by him for his betterment.
Isn't it something? He was traveling, you know, traveling, and he loved the natural world. He loved the outdoors so much that, you know, that makes
I watch those nature shows.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and Helen said that he just, on days where things were hard or where he seemed distracted, or, you know, that just always brought him to life somehow.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I mean, there's, you know, the punning here.
I know. Yeah.
And like, and including his book that he did with Helen.
Yeah. The bluffing.
You know, Helen is obviously ever present, you know, in his poems, just as always.
Well, let's move further through the collection.
All right. Let's see. This one is titled Believe. Radiation's award for 10 treatments wins me a certificate of completion with the word believe bordering all four sides. I frame it quickly and show it to all who visit me. There's something about belief, some point of passage where I can't stop now with only one or two treatments left. I believe in the finality of a job well done and what the future may hold if I can hold on for the magic of 10. Close my eyes and count to 10. The big 10 in the old conference that meant the world to me. Cheers from Dr. Sun, from Kinnick Stadium, from my 10 days in the directed sunlight of autumn and red-tipped leaves ready to fall.
He does. He does get you into it, doesn't he?
You can't hardly read them. And I started, just as I was listening to you read and as I was looking at the text that I have, just writing down the words that stand out to me. Warm, joy, new, magic, a monitor named Charlie. You know, it's like...
Yeah, that's great. I love it.
The whole attitude of, generosity and... just humility and kindness, I think, is...
And acceptance.
Yeah.
Just acceptance of what is.
Yep.
That sometimes is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
It really is.
For sure.
How do they continue now?
I've got the last two poems in the manuscript, which I believe were both dictated, which I think makes them even
he
more...
He still kept... When he couldn't write.
When he couldn't write
anymore.
Yeah,
that's my understanding.
He still dictated.
Yeah.
Yep. He talked about that the last time I saw him, where he said Helen writes them down, but he said sometimes, you know, I dictated to my kids. So.
Yeah. So the penultimate poem in the manuscript is called Life, Loving and Living. I'm glad I spent most of my time on this earth loving a beautiful woman who is now my wife, Helen, and our three children, Rita, Randy, and Renee, and our grandchildren. Loving is easy when you have support from family and friends and people in Cancer Clinic A who have our fondest admiration and keep my steady health in mind. I want the last words in this book to include what we all aspire to, a better life.
Oh, I can't stand it.
Well, knowing him,
I know,
makes it really tough.
Yeah.
But the serenity in his language is just outstanding.
That's what we both noticed, I think, when I was talking. I mean, he's always written beautifully, but there was something in these poems that was a different register.
Yeah, for sure. And like, and you know, less important, but still present is like the craft of it all.
I mean, yeah.
Which is something maybe we can talk about once we get through the poems, but like, as you know, having read his poems for as long as I have, I really noticed, you know, never stop changing, never stop doing different things. Like never, you know, there's just like these little craft elements. That
line
like,
breaks and
just,
the musical quality.
That.
Breaks, he's brilliant with
it's just,
that.
It's such a lesson and such a
It must be something blessing. To dictate what you know will be the final poem.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Especially to, you know, I think this might have been dictated to his daughter. I can't even, so.
Well, and Helen's comments, when I had asked her to choose some, she was commenting on some of them that she sent. And without, she said that title and said, well, the poem kind of says it all. And it does.
Yeah.
For sure.
So, okay, this is the last poem.
This is the last poem in the manuscript. And it's called, excuse me, it's called Revisiting My Quality of Life, Memories Dictated to My Children from My Hospice Hospital Bed in My Home. We're all revisiting our quality of life. My father brought chocolate milk to every student in the sixth grade class at Johnson School. Each one got half a pint because it was the right thing to do. Mr. McHugh was the teacher and he got 2 pints of chocolate milk. I did gymnastics between basketball quarters in high school and at Augustana College. I served 2 years in the Army, the last 18 months as an office clerk in Baumholder, Germany. I drank coffee there every day in the Army. The officer didn't want to see my hand unless I had a cup for him. I was the coffee man. I went to Captain Yoder's house for Christmas when I was in the Army. Dean Lawrence and I went to a pizza place on Sunday nights rather than eating on base. Quality of life means everything. What else can I say?
What else can I say?
That's his last line in the
book. With an exclamation point.
Yeah.
So like that joy, all those words that you were kind of pulling out, that, you know, the joy and the gratitude. And,
It's really a life lesson to read those poems and to think about the circumstances under which they were written. Dick was... He was a very calm man. That's what I remember.
I know.
All the times I encountered him, and it was always at ease. And I wonder, how do you master that?
Especially as a high school teacher of 30, however many years. I knew Dick through my uncle. He was a high school teacher of 30-some years, and my dad was a high school teacher middle school teacher of 35 years, something like that. And
I think Dick taught for 32 years at Central.
Not quite as calm as Dick. Not that they were, flying off the handle or anything, but Dick definitely had a calm to him.
I taught high school English and was constantly, I won't say tense, but the thing that drove me was, how do I get to every one of these students? How do you get everyone involved? What does it take?
There are different levels. There are different things going on at home. All of it.
I remember a kid went to sleep in my class, and so when the class was over, I went back to talk to him. So what's the deal? I know I'm boring, but this is. He said, no, I've got a full-time job. I said, why do you have a full-time job? He says, well, I got to pay for a car. I got a car and I got to pay for the upkeep. Boy, that's it.
Yeah.
And you're so gentle about it. I had a student when I was teaching at George Mason University who always fell asleep, and I brought a squirt gun in. He sat in the front row and slept right in front of me, so I brought a squirt gun and got him. But Dick was so loved by his students, and that's one reason you want a book to come of it, because people need it.
Yeah, there's still so many people. And he was the first poetry teacher I had. I pestered my uncle for much of my childhood to let me go to what is now the David R. Collins Writers Conference. He used to be the Mississippi Valley Writers Conference, and Dick would frequently teach at that, and he wouldn't let me do it until after I graduated high school and turned 18.
No.
So the first poetry workshop I ever took was Dick. And so years later, when I started teaching workshops back here after I moved back to the Quad Cities, Dick attending my workshops,
and there he
was
in your
so
audience.
Formidable.
Yeah.
In a way, but Dick was formidable in mind and spirit, and in the work and the craft. But as a person, he was anything but, and couldn't have been more gentle. And I remember. I don't remember what the workshop was because he came to all of the workshops.
Yeah, I know.
I do remember the first time seeing him you know, when the roles were reversed and I was kind of in the front of the classroom, and that being, I felt like I particularly had to be on my game a little bit, but yeah. Also felt really honored that, you know, someone who has dedicated his life to this craft and done so much good work is still showing up and, willing to contribute to a group conversation and share what he knows and learn some more. And I think that was evident all through these poems. Like,
exactly.
They feel different, not just for the subject matter and the difficulty of the process of writing them, as I would imagine, but they just feel differently. Like, it feels like so much. They feel like new and fresh, and they feel different than a lot of his other poems in a way that, like, I'm that just makes me even more excited and kind of committed to making sure these poems come out in the world in some form.
You know, you mentioned that this might be a work for the Writers' Center.
Midwestern Center.
Yeah,
how have you functioned during the pandemic?
Pretty well, actually. Writing being the very, it's a very adaptable form, right?
Yeah.
So we were among the first arts organizations to move to virtual programming. We were able to have pretty much all of our major programs last year, except the Children's Lit Fest. We still did some things for that, but we couldn't really have like 800 to 1,000 people, you know, right, at the River Center. So other than that, we've been able to do a lot. We've started some new programs. We're looking forward to doing things in person. We actually just had Beth Roberts back here for a book release reading. And we had about 100 people at Roz Talks outside, and that was beautiful. But
Wonderful. We've
managed pretty well, thanks to our staff, particularly Sarah Elgatian. Who's been instrumental in helping us make that transition and keep going.
Well, and Ryan, it was last summer, was it, when you asked if I'd teach, and I just said, I can't do the technology. So I came in, and there were you and Sarah, right? Just kind of clicking things on and off, and here was a, you know, it was all I had to do was talk.
Yeah, we committed to doing the conference virtually, and then we're like, how do we do the conference virtually?
I think
we figured it out pretty well. We're doing it the same way this year, but
that's good. And when you say that you will have a hand in publishing Dick Stahl's last poems, is that something that's been set, or is it in progress?
Well, it's in Helen's.
100%.
That's up to Helen. So, but we know that she would like to do that because she knows that it would matter to the people who love Dick's.
I've talked to her about it a few times and she knows how I feel about it. But it's, it's what she wants to do with them. I'm here to help her bring this book to the world in whatever way that we can. And not just for that, but I think, to honor Dick and for all the people who love Dick,
Yes,
definitely that. And because it's great poetry, also that. But also because, and I know both of our lives have been, really impacted by cancer. I think there's something to this book. There's a value to this book, I think, for people who don't read poetry.
Yeah.
I think if you're going through this, if you have a family member who's going through something similar to this, I think
exactly.
The value of these poems is immense, and I think would be, pretty far-reaching, and we'd love to be a part of that.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing this somehow in print at some point.
Definitely.
And I want to thank Ryan Collins for being with us today. And, of course, Rebecca Wee, my companion here in this little exercise in literature, the late poems of Dick Stahl. We hope to see them, and we hope to see you next week for the next edition of Scribble.